Well, good morning. Like I said earlier this morning, we are diving into this brand new series that we are calling In the Meantime. And over the course of the next 5 weeks, we're going to be addressing this question that admittedly we have all struck out at a time or two. What do you do when there's nothing you can do? Because the reality is when we look at our lives and we look back on our past, what we would admit is this. Is that there are times in our lives where there are problems we are facing that we can fix. But then sometimes we come up against problems that are just downright unfixable. We encounter moments in our lives where there are tensions that can be resolved. But then there are times in our lives where we face tensions that cannot be resolved. And what do we do in those moments where we feel stuck? What do we do in those moments where we're saying, in the meantime, what direction am I supposed to go? And what am I supposed to do with the circumstances that I find myself in? As many of you know, last week was our annual stand for Shelby. And it was an absolutely incredible day, not weather-wise, but it was an absolutely incredible day as we dove in and stood for our city. And admittedly, we did not know what it was going to look like this year. As we're sort of relaunching in-person services and you look around and you recognize not everybody is back yet, not everybody's comfortable being around others yet, we had that same question going through our mind of what is this year going to look like attendance-wise and how many people are actually going to be willing to jump in? And to have over 175 volunteers be a part of this one day for our city in the midst of whatever your feelings were, whatever nerves you had running through you, whatever risk you thought you were taking was just absolutely incredible. But one of the things, if you participated in Stand for Shelby, that you knew was just a little bit off was this. And this is one thing that for a perfectionist like me, absolutely drove me crazy. Last week for Stand for Shelby, every year in the last 6 years, we have had t-shirts that everyone wears on that day. And this year, our t-shirts did not make it on time. On Thursday afternoon, we got the email, the tracking update, that our shipment was going to be delayed and it was not going to arrive until Monday. And as soon as I received that email, I hopped on the phone immediately with our t-shirt provider, and then I immediately went to FedEx. And for the next 48 hours, I spoke with about 5 different customer advocate team members who were supposed to be advocating on my behalf, and we threw out every solution we knew. I even offered, if you could just get our shipment somewhere in Kentucky within about a 6-hour drive, I will drive there, we'll stop the shipment there, I'll drive there, I'll pick it up so that we can have t-shirts on the day. And by about, my wife can attest to this, by about 10:30 on Saturday night, as I finally hung up the phone again with another customer advocate team member who promised they were going to be calling me back with a solution and then never got back to me, I finally recognized this is a problem I cannot do anything about. I cannot solve this. I cannot fix this. I cannot make this right in the moment. And you see, while that is just a small snippet of what happened last week, what we all can acknowledge is that we have encountered moments like that in our lives, right? We have all had moments where we want to fix something so badly to make it right. And we exacerbate every single thing we can possibly think of to make it right. And at the end of the day, it still isn't right. It still isn't fixable. For some of us, we find ourselves in the meantime moments in our marriages. And the two of us know that divorce isn't an option. We would never go down that path. And yet deep down inside of both of us, what we also acknowledge is this. Neither one of us really want to change. And we find ourselves stuck in this place where we're not going to end this, but this isn't going to get any better. Maybe we find ourselves stuck in this place in our kids' lives. And for years, we've been telling them that those grades and that ACT test is important. And they just gave you that same old line. You know what I'm talking about. I know, Mom. I know, Dad. And yet here they find themselves at the end of their high school career, and their options are severely limited because they didn't take the things seriously that you told them to take seriously. Maybe for some of us, we find ourselves in the middle of this in our finances. And we've started to take some healthy steps, and we've made a budget, and we've started to live by it. But yet what we know financially is this. We're in a place where we have made some bad decisions in our past, and digging out of those holes is not something that happens quickly or immediately. And getting our finances back to where we want them to be is something that is going to take time and something that is going to have to happen over the long run. For some of us, it's in our family. And while we were dating that special someone, their family didn't seem so bad. But yet here we find ourselves in the middle of marriage a few years in or a few decades in, and we're beginning to realize over time that we are stuck with a family, we are stuck with in-laws, and we cannot do anything about it. I know, I see y'all nervous laughter going on. For some of us, it's health. And we've visited the doctor and we've gotten that diagnosis, and it's not something that's going to kill us. We're not going to die from this, but it's also not something that can be cured. And it's inconvenient and there's pain involved, and we can treat it, but we can't get rid of it altogether. For some of us, we find ourselves in this tension when it comes to our kids. In the middle of this pandemic, being faced with a decision that is right in front of us in the next couple of weeks of what's the right thing to do for my kids? What's the right thing to do for them academically? What's the right thing to do for them physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually? And it feels like any decision that we make, there is no right answer. There is no right direction to go. Do we send them back? Do we allow them to do this? Do we allow them to do that? If we do, there will be one side that's against us. If we don't, there will be one side that's against us. We find ourselves in these moments time and time again in our lives where we're wondering, what do I do when there's nothing I can do to fix this? And in those moments, deep down, what we would admit is this: we all crave one thing, the fix, right? Because somewhere along the way in our lives, as we've become adults, we have been convinced by the culture and the society around us that every problem has an immediate solution. If you try hard enough, go in the right places, you can fix any problem. And oftentimes that belief has led us to look for solutions in all the wrong places. Ever been there? We thought maybe the solution to our loneliness was just to say yes to the first person that came along. And what we missed is that while it somewhat fixed the loneliness in the short term, saying yes to the wrong person actually led to more problems and exacerbated the problem of loneliness in the long term. It actually made our loneliness worse by looking for the solution in the wrong places. For some of us, we thought, man, if I just drink that away, and I just have a few more drinks on the weekend, then it can push my problems and my feelings down, and I just won't think about it, or I just won't feel it. And it started to create this ripple effect in our marriages and our relationship with our kids and so many areas of our lives where we thought the fix was just to sort of wash those feelings and those emotions and those hurts away. And in the process, we've created new hurts in other areas of our lives. Maybe we've thought the fix to the problem is to simply be jealous enough to go after somebody else's life. We don't like the situation that we're stuck in. And so maybe if I do everything possible to go after their life, then my life will become better. And in the process of going after their life, we lose everything that's good about our own. Or maybe the solution is just to straight up get angry. To get angry at somebody else that we feel like has caused those problems in our lives, or frankly, let's just put it out there, right? We're willing to be honest. I'm willing to be honest, to get mad at God, because if he really loved me and he was really in control, then he could fix this now and he could do something about these in the meantime moments that we find ourselves in. And we've been living this life for the past 3 months, 6 months, 10 years, and God could have fixed this in the first day if he really wanted to. And so we find ourselves getting angry and we think that maybe that'll solve the problem and maybe that'll fix it. But all it does is this. It just stirs the anger pot in which we find ourselves getting angry more and more and more with the circumstances that just don't seem fair in our lives. And oftentimes as we go looking for the fix, there are those church people in our lives who just make it worse, right? Like for some of us, we've encountered this moment in our lives, right, where we're in casual conversation with a real good church person, and they throw out this line: man, the other day, God answered a huge prayer for me. And because we find ourselves in the meantime moments, we ask that one question that about 5 minutes later we wish we wouldn't have asked. We say, oh yeah, how's that? And they start in on this story with you. The other day, I lost my keys. And I had no idea where they were at. And we turned over the house looking for them, and we were freaking out at what this was going to look like and how we were going to replace the set of keys. And we've been looking all day. And then my husband, who's just the greatest husband in the whole world, he decided to come home from work early to surprise me. And you're already like, I know this story is going no place good. And the internal eye rolls begin. And as soon as my perfect husband walked through the front door, we heard the jingle, and my keys had been stuck in the front door the whole time, and God answered this ginormous prayer. And deep down inside of us, we are like, shut up. You don't even know what a real problem is. I don't even like you right now for telling me that story. I don't like you enough. I don't even want to be in a small group with you. Losing my keys would be an upgrade for the life that I'm living. Would be an upgrade for the problems that I am going through, from the tension that I'm feeling, from the things that just don't seem to be able to be fixed for me are far bigger than whether or not to get a lost set of keys replaced. And we find ourselves time and time again faced with circumstances and problems that there's no easy way out. There's no quick fix. And the longer we find ourselves in the meantime, the more we have a tendency to buy into these lies that the enemy wants to plant in your life and in my life. These lies that are dangerous as we move forward. And as we kick off this series, I thought it was only fitting as we talk about these moments in our lives for us to address those lies, to put them out there, for us to acknowledge those lies that so often we buy into when we find ourselves in the meantime. You see, the first lie that the enemy wants to put in your life and in my life when we find ourselves stuck and waiting is this: I will never be happy again. That person, my spouse, my kids, they were my whole life. And now that's become broken, and my life will never go back to the same. My life will never be good again. I will never be able to be happy because this area of my life is broken and I don't see a fix in the future. Or secondly, we buy into the lie that nothing good can come from this. It's a logical place for our eyes to look, right? As humanity, we always look at the worst situations of our lives when it hasn't been fixed in a certain amount of time and we don't know how it's going to be fixed. And what we conclude is this: there is absolutely nothing good that can come from this. This is all doom and gloom. This is always the worst case scenario. Or third, we start to buy into the lie that there is no point in continuing. That we're stuck here in the meantime, in unfair circumstances, in problem places, in problems in our marriages. And maybe it's just not worth continuing to push forward and continuing to try. Maybe it's about time to just throw in the towel. Or maybe my life has become so bad that my life isn't even worth living anymore. And there's just no point in continuing. You see, the reason that the enemy places these lies in your life and in my life is this. As you look at each of those three things, what you'll recognize about number one is this: the enemy wants to do everything possible to rob you of your joy in life. When you look at number two, the enemy wants to do everything possible to rob you of your hope in life. And when you look at number three, the enemy wants to do everything possible to rob you of your purpose in life. And the best place that he knows how to do that is in the moments of your life where you feel stuck in the middle of a problem. He will throw every weapon at you to make you begin to believe that. But here's what's so incredible. The good news is that if you are a Christian, the New Testament speaks directly to this one place that we want to know the answer to. In the middle of these moments, does God even see what I'm going through? Does God even care? If you're a Christian, the New Testament speaks directly to those questions that we have. And the good news is, if you are not a Christian, the New Testament speaks directly to those questions that you have. You see, what we see time and time again in the story of this guy named Jesus and in the lives that followed, the real lives that followed the story of this man named Jesus, what we see is this truth continue to pop up again and again and again as they find themselves in the meantime, as they find themselves beginning to believe those lies. I'll never be happy again. Nothing good can come from this. There's no point in continuing to push forward. What we see continue to pop up and what we see God continue to speak into their lives is what he's speaking into yours and mine right here in the middle of our problems this morning. That I am not absent. I am not apathetic. And I am not angry. When we find ourselves in the meantime, we must hold on to the truth that even though we feel stuck, God's not absent, apathetic, or angry. No matter what you're walking through or how bad your life looks, we can hold on to that truth. And I know it's hard to believe. We've all fallen into the trap that that just isn't true, or we've been fed bad theology, that the circumstances we are walking through is because somehow God is angry at my past and my mistakes and the decisions that I've made. But that just isn't true. And you're saying, Ben, how do you know that isn't true? How do you know that God isn't absent, apathetic, and that he isn't angry at me because of the mistakes that I have undoubtedly made in my past? We only have to go back to one place to see the truth. We go back to this one place that so many of us have heard, this place that we have read this passage from again and again and again, and it's where we're going to dive into this morning. If you haven't done so already, this is a perfect opportunity for you to grab your weekly. There's been some things that have come up already on the screen for you to fill in, but you can pull that out, and there's a notes page in there that'll help you follow along as we move through the text. But this morning, we're going to dive into John chapter 3, verse 16. And here is how this passage goes, the one that so many, if not all of us, know. It says this: "For this is how God loved the perfect people. For this is how God loved the people who finally got their act together. For this is how God loved the Jews." It doesn't say any of that. "For this is how God loved the world. He gave his one and only son." You're saying, Ben, I don't get it. How does that passage point out that God is not absent, apathetic, or angry at me? You see, what this verse underlines is this incredible truth. God is not angry at you. Why? He poured it all out on his son. Have you ever noticed that before? Have you ever thought about that? That God released every ounce of his anger on the cross. He put every piece of anger that he should have held towards you and towards me firmly on the shoulders of his son as he hung up there and died on a cross. On that cross, all of God's anger for you and for me as his loved children was washed away. God is not apathetic. Sending his only son to this earth to put on flesh and blood and to hang on a cross and die and take on the sins of the world, that is the most proactive step you could possibly take. That he was willing to go to any means necessary, as far as sacrificing what was most precious to him, to fix what was broken between us and him. That doesn't sound like an apathetic God. And God is not absent. Because when he sent his son to this earth, he was putting into motion a new plan. A new plan that ensured that you and I never had to walk through the troubles of our life alone. That God would walk in us. That he would live through us. That our God would always be with us. No matter how bad things got, no matter how bad we got, that our God would never be absent from that moment forward in our lives or in our circumstances. But if in those in the meantime moments, you have found yourself believing that God is still and God is silent, what I want you to know is this: you are not alone. And you are not the first one who has believed that. You're not the first one who has struggled with that. You see, we find this struggle happening in the lives of those who were closest to this man named Jesus. And this morning, we're going to talk about two stories in the lives of two men who were probably the closest two men to Jesus in their time here on earth. Two guys that Jesus loved, two guys that Jesus respected, two guys that Jesus gave an incredible amount of authority. And in these two guys' lives, as they walked through the troubles of their lives, as they found themselves in the meantime, stranded in the midst of their problems and their hurt and their pain, these guys struggled with those exact same thoughts that you and I struggle with. The first guy that we find struggling with that is a guy named John the Baptizer. And I say John the Baptizer, y'all know him as John the Baptist. But I didn't want to confuse anything here. John wasn't called John the Baptist because way back when he went to the First Baptist Church. He was known as John the Baptist because he was known for baptizing so many Jews and proclaiming this new way through Jesus Christ. But towards the end of John's ministry, we find himself literally being stranded in the middle of nowhere. In the midst of an in-the-meantime moment, wondering when the fix is going to come. Near the end of John's ministry, he gets thrown into prison. And to set up the reason why John gets thrown into prison, you have to know a little bit of the backstory of what's taking place. If we think back to the Christmas story, many of us know the Christmas story, yes? We think back to the Christmas story, Jesus was born. And when Jesus was born, there was this rumor that was circulating that he was the Messiah, that the Messiah had finally come and he would become the king of the Jews. And guess what? The current king didn't really like a new unknown baby being called the future king of the Jews. And so this dude that didn't like that very much was named King Herod. And King Herod set out this search to find Jesus. And when he couldn't find Jesus, what he determined to do was this: in order to protect my kingdom and my kingship, I will have every baby boy under the age of 2 murdered in my kingdom. That's King Herod. Now, a guy with that much ego, it naturally trickles down into the way in which you name your children. And so King Herod eventually gives up his seat as king to his son, who he has named King Herod. Herod Antipas becomes the king. And Herod Antipas has a brother named Herod Philip. He names all of his kids Herod. He even has a niece that is named Herodias, right? It's like me naming all my kids Ben, and then we get down to a girl, and it's Benita or something like that. And so he names all of his kids by Herod. And so his brother, Herod Philip, marries his niece, Herodias. And I'm sure there's some confusion happening there because there's things taking place that don't even happen in the South. She's like, honey or uncle or what do I call you? I'm not real sure. But Herod Philip takes this trip to Rome. And while he's in Rome, his wife slash niece has an affair with his brother, the king, Herod Antipas. And by the time Herod Philip has come back to his kingdom, Herodias has married his brother, the other uncle. And there's no tabloids at this time, but the news has spread throughout the kingdom. Everyone knows the affair that has taken place and the wife swap that has happened here. And because of that, John begins to speak out against what they are seeing. He begins to denounce this detestable behavior that the king has entered into. And he begins to speak about how our family should not model after that. Our marriages should not look like that. And as you can only imagine, this young girl, Herodias, as she hears John speaking out against the despicable acts that she has done, she gets mad. And she goes to her new husband, the king, Herod Antipas, and she says, honey, I want you to get this dude and I want you to throw him in jail. And as any good husband does, yes, dear, right? And so he goes and he finds John the Baptist and he throws him in prison. But not just any prison. Herodias has a special request. I want you to throw him into the worst prison we have. And so King Herod sends John to the easternmost border of the kingdom, in the middle of the desert, to a prison named Machaerus. John is thrown into the dungeon of this place. And he waits, and he waits, and he waits, locked up and starving and hurting, knowing that there's ministry to be done, and yet he can't do it. Scholars believe that John was in prison for over 18 months. And as he waits and he waits and he waits, undoubtedly all of these thoughts begin to pop into his mind. This great friend of mine named Jesus is doing all of these miracles. Why isn't he coming through for me? Why isn't he taking care of this? Why isn't he fixing my problems? And the doubts about this guy named Jesus begin to rise to the surface. Why hasn't Jesus done anything? Why hasn't he even come to visit me? And I think so many of these doubts rise to the surface because John knows just how highly Jesus thinks of him. We see Jesus say it in Matthew chapter 11, verse 11. This is what he thinks of John. Check this out. I tell you the truth, of all those who have ever lived, none is greater than John the Baptist. John is the greatest human being to ever walk on this earth. That's what Jesus is saying here. And you can just imagine Jesus' disciples gathered around him as Jesus says this. And he's like, Jesus, really? Like, John's greater than your father? Yeah. Your mother? I said greatest. And then you can just imagine the disciples, like, with all their selfishness that we've seen in story after story, they're like, John's surely not greater than us. Yes. John is the greatest man to ever walk on this earth. That's what Jesus thought of John. But here's what's crazy, and here's where the doubts begin to rise to the surface. Jesus' actions seem to contradict what he said. John begins to think, if I'm the greatest human being to ever walk on this earth and Jesus thinks that highly of me, why isn't he doing something? Why isn't he coming to visit me, right? For a man Jesus thought so highly of, as soon as John was thrown into prison, what would you assume that Jesus did? Sent him a gift basket? Took food to him? Went and visited him? Jesus didn't do any of that. In fact, this is what we see Jesus do when John is thrown into prison. In Matthew chapter 4, starting in verse 12, here is how the story goes. When Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he left Judea and returned to Galilee. He went first to Nazareth, then left there and moved to Capernaum beside the Sea of Galilee, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. Now, many times, if you've read through any of the Gospels or you've read through the book of Matthew, what you recognize is that you've read this passage and you're like, oh, that's great. It's just another passage in there. Jesus was moving again. He was going to teach somewhere else. And we just kind of move on. But to get the full weight of exactly what's taking place, I thought it was best interpreted for you to see the actual map of what's taking place here. And so what we see here, and I'm going to help y'all. I'm going to point this out. What we see here is that John is thrown into prison all the way on the eastern border in Machaerus over here. And Jesus initially is in Judea. So Jerusalem is kind of the epicenter of Judea. Jesus is somewhere in this vicinity. As soon as he hears that John has been thrown into prison in Machaerus, Jesus goes from this region up to Nazareth. He moves away from John. He spends a short amount of time in Nazareth, and then what does he do? He comes back down and he visits John in Machaerus. No. He spends a short amount of time in Nazareth, and then he goes even further north, right up against the Sea of Galilee, to a place called Capernaum. And so in this moment, in the midst of John's despair, Jesus actually moves away, further away from John. And just to set this into context a little more for you all, this is so incredible. We have a picture. This, you can actually go visit this. This is landmark. This is where, you'll see a picture here. This is where Machaerus is actually located. This is the view on the top of the hill of the prison in Machaerus. You're like, okay, I might go look at that if I have air conditioning and make a stop there to say that I've been there. This is where John is located in the midst of all of this dryness, in the dry season of his life. And this is where Jesus chooses to go in Capernaum.
Jesus goes to the beach. He's like sitting under a cabana having a good time while John is in prison, while John is going through a moment of his life where he is stuck in the desert dungeon in the middle of nowhere, going through the worst moments of his life. And he has been stuck there for 18 months, and frankly, he has had it. He's frustrated, he's jealous, he's angry, he's lonely. He wants a fix. And so he calls the guys who have been feeding him. This is so good. If you didn't know this, when you get thrown into Macharis, they don't feed you at Macharis. You have to have people who love you enough to visit you every day and bring you food, or they just allow you to starve to death in Macharis. And so there are these disciples that have been coming, giving John food every day to keep him alive. And so he calls these disciples of him that have been bringing food, and he says, hey, I want you to go to Jesus, and I want you to ask him this question. I want you to see what's up with Jesus. I want you to address these doubts that I have. And so the guys, they go down there and they confront Jesus and they begin to have this conversation with Jesus. And you can just imagine, right? They roll up on the beach in Capernaum where Jesus is, and they see him sitting there under a cabana, and they start to have this conversation. And they're like, Jesus, we got a question for you that we're going to take back to John the Baptist. We're not going to tell him like what's going on here and the lap of luxury that you're living in, because John's depressed enough right now, and he's in a hard enough place. But here's the question that John wanted us to ask you. In verse 2, it says this. John the Baptist, who was in prison, heard about all the things that Jesus was doing. So he sent his disciples to ask Jesus this question. Are you the Messiah we've been expecting? Or should we keep looking for someone else? Are you really the Messiah? Are you really the Son of God? Because right now, I'm having a really hard time believing that you care about me, that you're in my corner, that you're everything that I believed that you were, that you are who you said you are. And Jesus, instead of responding to the circumstances that John finds himself in, he responds in a completely different way. Jesus told them, go back to John and tell him what you have heard and seen. The blind see, the lame walk. Those with leprosy are cured. The deaf hear. The dead are raised to life. And the good news is being preached to the poor. In this moment, Jesus' response doesn't focus on John's circumstances. It's like he looks at John's disciples and he says, I want you to take this message back to John. In the midst of what you are going through, your trust, your faith, your belief in me doesn't always have to be predicated on the circumstances that you find yourself walking through and whether or not I fix those or not. Sometimes your trust and your faith can be seen in what I am doing in the lives of people around you, in the way in which I am standing beside people who are hurting more than you, people who have been stuck in the meantime for longer than you have been stuck there. That you can continue to trust in me even if you don't agree with my timing. And John's guys, they get up and they begin to walk away. And then Jesus huddles his disciples back in and he finishes the story in this incredible way. He says this in verse 6. And he added, God blesses those who do not fall away because of me. What? What does Jesus even mean by that? Jesus says to his disciples, what I want you to understand is this. Blessed are those who do not interpret my silence as my absence. Blessed are those who do not fall away, who do not walk away, who do not lose trust, who do not lose faith, just because they don't agree with my timing. Just because I haven't come through for them yet. Blessed are those who continue to trust me and believe in me, whether their prayers get answered in the way they want or not. Just like John the Baptist. Jesus knew all about John and his circumstances, and our Heavenly Father knows all about your circumstances and the places in which you feel stuck. But that's not the only scenario in which we see this happening. We see this happen in the life of another man. A man that Jesus was close to, considered to be one of his best friends. And in a situation, a circumstance of this man's life where things are going south fast, there are messengers that are sent to Jesus to deliver this message. We see it in John chapter 11. So the two sisters, Mary and Martha, sent a message to Jesus telling him, Lord, your dear friend is very sick. They don't even have to say the name of the man. They just say, your dear friend. And what we all know, or what some of us know, is that this messenger is talking about the sickness of Lazarus. That's right. Your dear friend has become sick. And in this moment, some translations actually tell the story that Jesus' disciples begin to stand up. As they hear the message, they just expect, we're going right now. This is your dear friend. We all know you love him. We've spent so much time around him. We're going. We're going to fix this solution. And some translations say that Jesus looked at his disciples and said, sit down. I know you don't understand this, but God's doing something greater here than what you see. So although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was at for the next 2 days. Don't confuse God's absence for God's apathy. Even though there was more in the meantime to come for Lazarus, there was a solution at the end that was far greater in his life, far greater for the kingdom that happened because of the waiting. You have something in common with these two men, with Lazarus and John the Baptist. Just because things don't change in the meantime doesn't mean God cares any less. He is working. He is fighting for you. And that very place is the best foundation for this series possible. That just because God feels absent, just because God feels still, just because God feels silent, doesn't mean that he is. See, we have a choice. We can focus on the lies when we find ourselves in the meantime, or we can choose to see the truth. We can say, I'm not going to lose my joy. I'm not going to lose my hope. I'm not going to lose my purpose. I'm going to see this for what it really is. And even though I could believe that I'll never be happy again, what I will choose to look at is this. I can be happy again. Things can be fixed. Things can be worked out. I can hold on to joy because of who my Savior is. Something good can come from this. God can use this for his good. God can use this for my good. And while it hurts in the moment, on the back end, we will see it for what it really is. And we choose to see that, no, it's not that there's no point in continuing, but there can actually be a purpose in this pain. And I know, in the middle of the waiting, holding on to those truths doesn't feel like it fixes everything. Oftentimes in week one of a series, we don't feel like things are fixed, but trust me, we will get there. Blessed are those who do not fall away because of me, because of my timing. And I get it, your circumstances are no laughing matter. They're frustrating and they hurt and they're painful. And you definitely need some reassurance that God is there and that God cares. You see, if you were anything like me when I was a kid, I used to sing this song. He's got the whole world in his hands. And I think deep down in the moments of hurt, the only question we want an answer to is this. Does God have my whole world in his hands? And the reassurance that we have is this. The reassurance that we hold on to in week one is this. He does. Even when you can't feel it, even when you don't see it, he does. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for what a great God you are. And even when we find ourselves in the middle of unfixable problems and unresolvable tensions, when we find ourselves in the meantime, your silence doesn't equate to your absence. You are still there. You still know. You still care. God, may we choose to not focus on the lies that I'll never be happy again and no good can come from this and there's no point in continuing. And can we fix our eyes on the truth? You are not absent, you are not apathetic, you are not angry. And that allows us to see that I can be happy again. Something good can come from this. And there can be a purpose to this pain. And may that spur us forward to keep going, to persevere in the meantime. It's in your name that I pray.